And welcome to Thursday night's programme. August Balachty na Féile Páirc Oraibh Galair. A very happy St. Patrick's Day to you all. I hope that you've enjoyed your festivities so far. As you know, the Irish have always enjoyed a reputation as storytellers. But as we celebrate 100 years since the founding of the state, what stories are we now telling about ourselves and about our recent history? From films like Black 47, which put the famine on the big screen, to Abomination, an opera about homophobia in Northern Ireland, to Anna Burns' Booker Prize-winning novel Milkman. Ireland's storytelling across music, art, literature, theatre and film has become increasingly diverse as we reflect on how we see ourselves. So this evening, here on Arena, we've invited five of our regular contributors to choose some works that resonate for them on this St. Patrick's Day. With me are author June Caldwell, artist Amanda Coogan, film critic Paul Whittington, theatre director Conor Hanratty and Joe Chibby, the general manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra. Balachty na Féile Oraibh Cúigear. All five of you, very happy St. Patrick's Day. Let's start with film, Paul. And we will be talking about contemporary reflections for sure, but we're going quite a bit back, quite a distance in time here into Irish history, because our conversations aren't confined to our recent past. Two Oscar-nominated films from the animation studio Cartoon Saloon, The Secret of T'Kells from 2009, last year's Wolfwalkers, hugely popular. What do you think it is about, you know, this type of film which goes right back in history that has struck such a chord with contemporary Ireland?
Well, I think, Sean, that the film industry has become more confident in recent years. In days gone by, even into the 60s, 70s and 80s, we didn't have an industry big enough to take on subjects like this. This has become a centre of excellence for animation in this country. And these two films, having watched them with my son, they're an extraordinary introduction into the deep recesses of Irish history. Mm. The Secret of T'Kells is obviously set in a monastery, and it's beautifully sort of animated in the style of the book, and the monks are trying to finish the book that will turn everything to light, and outside the Vikings are coming and so on. It's a beautiful film and it's very touching as well.
And Wolfwalkers is a real history lesson, yeah. Particularly a history lesson in and around Kilkenny.
It is. Oliver Cromwell, Everybody Boo on our national day, is not mentioned in the film by name, but he is there, and Kilkenny is a walled town. While the locals had, you know, 20 names for every shade of a leaf, the invaders, nature is the enemy. They want to wipe all the wolves out, but there's magic at work, and some of the wolves are people. And that gave context without going overboard, because one of the sort of heroine in it, one of the protagonists, is actually English, and which is clever because it takes a bit of the kind of heat out of the subject. But still, it gives you a great idea of that seismic change when, as it were, the modern world at the time replaced the Celtic one.
Well, as you say, one of the heroines is definitely an English character, but one of them is an Irish character. If a wolf girl can be Irish, Maeve Óg MacTíre, voiced by Eva Whittaker. And here she is giving us a sense from the film, a clip that gives us a sense of this mythology around wolf people.
I don't suppose you know much about the wolf walkers, do you? A long time ago, the Irish were mad superstitious, telling tales like the man wolves of Ossory. Men and women who are cursed to live in the forest as wolves while their human bodies lay sleeping. Back then, they believed anything wild was the work of the devil, because these wolf walkers, they call them, are said to have a wild kind of magic. Healing powers that can banish what ails you out of thin air. They can even see smells with their wolf vision. Oh, and be careful, they bite. Because if you're bitten, you'll be a wolf walker too. How do I know, you ask? Because I am one.
It's just such fun, even listening back to that. Yes. That's a clip there from Wolfwalkers, and it's one of the choices on this St. Patrick's evening from Paul Whittington, that one, in fact. We're looking at this idea of how contemporary art looks back at items from history or events from history, and how we understand them in the light of today's culture. June Caldwell, but Paul talking there about a kind of confidence in the film world. It strikes me that there's a kind of a confidence there in the publishing world at the moment as well, certainly around Irish Irish writing. I love the book that you've picked. Very unusual perspective here. A blend of history. Yeah, myth is in here. Legend is in here. All implicit in Niall McCormack's book, Grand Stuff. Wait for it. A History of Label Art, published just last month. Now, the cultural significance of labels. Give us your thoughts on that, first of all, June.
Well, it really is a fascinating look at Ireland over the times. I didn't realise that, you know, Guinness would have been printing millions of labels per week, and that each part of Ireland would have had its very own localised labels for their bars. And you can tell by the image and the text on these labels, you know, just what the local feel is for the Ireland that they want to portray. Like, there's an export beer called Golden Leprechaun that I don't think any of us will remember. Golden Leprechaun light beer, you know, and it's bottled by Cairns and Drogheda. And that's just, you know, whoever drank that. While one of the ones that was not an export beer is called Knuckle Duster. And it's just a picture of, obviously, a fist with a some kind of iron yoke around it. And it's Knuckle, Beamish Knuckle Duster Irish Stout. And that's brewed at home, because obviously we export our leprechauns and then we just knock the head off each other back in the Midlands, you know. So it's very, very interesting just to have a look through this book and see exactly what was going on from a cultural perspective over the different decades. You know, it's also quite a beautiful book. It's a real coffee table book. Like, it's gorgeous. Anything produced by Niall McCormack is. He's a graphic designer of book covers and record sleeves anyway. But yeah, it's a fantastic book.
And he speaks, I think, in the book as well, June, about Yeats and Joyce and their understanding around the importance of printed material and label art.
Yeah, he does. He talks that both Yeats and Joyce understood the importance of printed and label art as rich repositories of society's foibles and predilections, and they are an integral part of the fabric of visual culture, and that they also tell stories, like, you know, obviously from the leprechaun labels to the Red Hand of Ulster. There's loads of these red-handed ales in there as well that I've never seen or heard of. And he also, in there, it's not just booze, by the way, there's old hotel labels which kind of show you how Irish people, at least the rich ones, holidayed at the time, and that the foods they ate, the beauty treatments, the travel, the whole lot. It's actually just a fascinating journey just to sit down with this book for an hour or two and wander through it.
Yeah, I guess any of us really could think of, you know, if you were to think of a label from your childhood, even Amanda Coogan, you know, a label from your childhood that immediately evokes that period in time. It has that facility, you know, if you think of Ready Break, for example, that's the one that somehow has come to my mind, and that glowy kind of feel, the artistry of that. It really does evoke something.
Yeah, I think it's material culture, really, that is so evocative of a time or a place or a feeling, really. Mm. Material culture does permeate through all our experiences, doesn't it?
And in the one of the works that you've chosen for us this evening, this is Helen Kamak's film work, The Long Note. We really are here looking about an intersection between the past and the present. I suppose the visual arts can look at the past and the present in a very non-linear way, can't they?
That's the beauty of the visual arts. I would, of course, advocate that. But Helen Kamak's amazing The Long Note is in its moving image, so it is a film work. It's on view actually in the Irish Museum of Modern Art at the moment, and what she did was Mary Cremin up in the Void in Derry commissioned her to make an exploration, an artwork that looked at the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Marches in Derry. And Helen Kamak's work really interweaves, kind of sews together different things. So what she did was she went back to, she's bringing back women's voices which haven't been written into the official history of that time. And she interviewed women who were involved and marched at the time. Of course, the most famous one we know is Bernadette McAlasky. And she interviewed those, and she intersects the footage of the actual marches with footage from the US, from the civil rights marches in the US, footage of Nina Simone playing, and really makes a very, very beautiful, very open, very rich film work. I couldn't recommend watching it highly enough. Of course, it won the Turner Prize as well, which is the, you know, a big prize to win in the visual arts world.
Well, if the visual arts can evoke things in this non-linear way, I don't know what adjective we can describe as to what music can do, Joe Chibby. And obviously with the RTE Concert Orchestra, that's what you're dealing in a daily basis. But music has that facility as well, doesn't it? It really can evoke memories in a way that we're talking about with June's labels there. Music has the facility to kind of pull us into a new place that we can't necessarily describe intellectually in words.
It does, yeah. I mean, it just, I suppose it pushes emotion. If there's a story to be told, adding music to it usually helps. It certainly doesn't detract from it. I've yet to hear that happen, to be honest. And we do have a number of films and occasions through our history that music has been added to with TV and film and actually, in fact, many different bands through history that have taken on the ideas of our stories and added to them, and they do provoke emotion, that's for sure, you know.
Yeah, and the other thing is, again, if we want to pinpoint a period in history, particularly in popular music, we often hear about this is the soundtrack to the 80s or this is the soundtrack to the 90s, you know, and it brings us back to a particular decade. But you for your first piece that you've chosen for us this evening, Joe, you've chosen Paul Frost's work. This is The Burning of Cork, which was first performed by the RTE Concert Orchestra back in 2020. This is a commemorative piece, and obviously we're in the middle of this decade of commemoration right now. What was being remembered in The Burning of Cork? A difficult period, really, and a difficult event to bring to light and to start thinking about again.
Absolutely, yeah. So in 2020, I suppose the COVID started and people got busy writing things and whatever. And Paul Frost is one of our great musicians. He's a trombonist and a composer, arranger. He does a lot of arranging for us. And he decided, he's from Cork. And in 2007, while he was playing away, he was in Southampton and he was reading a book, The Burning of Cork by Jerry White and Brendan O'Shea. And he saw about December 11th, 2020, the tensions had built up. And basically, Cork was burnt down, a complete and heavy, brutal disaster in Cork's history. But he started writing a piece and he put it up on the internet with great interest. And then he came to us and he said, is there any chance we could, the RT Concert Orchestra could record it? And I think we were in lockdown, or we were in the unknown position in COVID. Mm. But we found a space when things got a bit lighter and we came into studio in groups of 15. So either the concert orchestra would be around 45 people. And we recorded his piece, which is beautiful. And his partner, Mia Cooper, who is the RT Concert Orchestra's concert master or leader, you might say, she played the violin solos on the piece. And it really is truly a beautiful piece.
Yeah, well, it certainly is evocative. And it, again, somehow brings us back, certainly as I listen to it, brings me right back to that period. So let's listen to a section of The Burning of Cork, the RTE Concert Orchestra here, and the violinist, the soloist that you will hear is Mia Cooper. Beautiful violin playing indeed there from Mia Cooper and the RTE Concert Orchestra. Paul Frost's composition, The Burning of Cork, one of the choices from RTE Concert Orchestra manager Joe Chibby, who is with me in studio alongside Amanda Coogan, Paul Whittingham, June Caldwell and Conor Hanratty. And just before I go to Conor Hanratty, suitably enough, who's in Cork this evening, The Burning of Cork in that particular section of the music sounds like a very pleasant event, Joe, but it does get it does get much more raucous and much more dramatic as the piece progresses.
It does. He said Paul was saying that he has tensions build through the whole thing, as you'd imagine. But he had a couple of movements. One was Martial Law. The other was Dylan's Cross. That was a piece, I think, from Dylan's Cross. And then the central movement, which is Hell Was Let Loose on the City.
Yeah.
Which describes the heavy, brutal, and disastrous burning of the city. But it's quite tuneless. And it's very, very heavy, and it does evoke the emotion of what happened.
Yeah, and the type of chaos that would be in and around that type of event. So sticking with Cork in terms of you, Conor Hanratty, you come from the performance side of things, and particularly in the theatrical sphere. Your most recent piece, Deep Roots, I suppose it was one of the deepest ones that we've had so far, an historical piece that we've been speaking about, an adaptation of Aeschylus's The Persians, Europe's oldest surviving play. Tell us about the Persians, and how does it link into Irish history, would you say?
Well, as you say, this is the oldest play in Europe in our performance history, and it's a play about a small island nation who have to their east very imperial leaning neighbours, and they have a long history of aggravation. And this is the play where it's in the aftermath of a huge battle, which the Greeks won. It's the Greeks and the Persians are the two I'm talking about. Nothing, if anything else, springs to mind. That's, of course, just an accident. And the play is extraordinary because it puts the audience in the perspective of the losing side, which happens to be the big empire, the Persians. But it's an amazing act of empathy and of shared experience, like trying to, from the earliest moment of theatre, to examine things from the other side and from the other perspective, which is a really beautiful thing. Now, the Greeks have their own problems, and perhaps it was only men who had the privilege of getting to watch these things. But as an idea, it's amazing, and it's always struck me that there might be something to be said from our own perspective with this play.
And the other interesting thing about this, given that it is Law na Siúnta, Law Éile Fáirc, this was Oscuilig. It was a translation, in fact, from Nuala Ní Gónaill, an Irish language adaptation of the piece.
Indeed. I've had the privilege of working in Greece a couple of times, and I've seen Greek plays in a variety of languages. And I always thought, we're sitting here on a 3,000-year-old language that we have a massive history of poetry and of metre and of expression. And I wondered what it would be like. So on spec, I emailed the unsuspecting Nuala, and amazingly she said yes. And she spent some time and she translated the play, which might have then become a workshop in the aforementioned 2020, but we were all stuck in our homes. So we turned it into a podcast instead throughout Dublin Theatre Festival, who kindly let us be a part of the party. So we made a radio programme and divided the play into 10 episodes to try and introduce people to what the play would sound like. And there's so much going on in the play as well, to slow it down and have some of our finest performers speak and even sing the play. And introduce people to it.
Yeah, and then of course you had some great speakers there as well in Catherine Ní Warracú, Bridge Ní Nachtan, No Problem with the Quailige there, Noan Roney, Erlo Linard.
I couldn't do better, really.
Yeah, present as well. And Paul Whittington, I mean, we've been speaking in recent times almost about a revival in terms of Irish language, particularly in the world of Irish language filmmaking.
Absolutely, it's been remarkable, and as we said last week after a show, a lot of it has to do with the T.G. Cahir initiative and so on, but the standard of Irish language films at the moment is remarkable. I think we might be talking about a new film, Colleen Kuhn, towards the end, but Aracht films like that, they just show the confidence with which Irish language writers are approaching stories.
And what's interesting is, I mean, the famine was always a subject that was almost, it wasn't touched or barely touched in terms of film, and very seldom even in terms of other literature or other art forms as well. But in Black 47, film from a few years back, this really did address the topic of famine, and it did so both Imerla and Oscar Eiliger.
It did, and it approached it through genre, which was a very interesting thing to do. Lance Daly decided to do that, I think, in a sense, because the famine is too big to be taken on directly. It's too big a trauma, and it would cost too much money to make that film anyway. So instead, he created a kind of Western set in Connemara, a returning soldier or mercenary, if you like, depending on your opinion, who's played by James Freshfield, comes back in the midst of the famine, and his family have been scattered to the four winds, driven off their land by the landlord, and he is basically out for revenge. So it is in many ways a Western. There's a great sort of cameo in it from a performance from Stephen Ray, and it has a kind of sort of cute peasant who'll survive anything. But I think it was a very interesting way to approach it, and it had never really been approached before.
Yeah, and indeed, let's play a clip which features the aforementioned James Freshfield. Now, he's here. He happens upon the eviction of an Irish family. He knows the family involved here, and the RIC man who's challenging him here is Carl Fitzgibbon, played by Mo Dunford, and inside the house is Ellie, played by Sarah Green. And you hear the Gaeilge just towards the end of this clip.
What's your business here?
Tell your men to get off the roof. I'll pay whatever's owed.
Not a question of money. The tenancy is illegal. They're moving in from the side of the road.
Move back, please.
At least let them leave peacefully.
How does this concern you?
Let me talk to them.
I won't ask you again. Stand down and let these men do their job.
Ellie! Oscar Ladonis!
They fuck like marching, no. Cherish a good to go, Hellier.
It's three core marching. Crook is she there, my aunt, she's a mach.
Ellie! Tara mach! Ach! A jock is shiver mach!
Recrea, be on me! Behold!
Take that young man into custody. The little thief.
No!
No!
Yeah, not too difficult to work out how chaotic that particular scene was from Black 47, an eviction there. And among the voices we heard, the actor James Freshfield, Mo Dunford as Fitzgibbon, and Sarah Green. I think it might have been Sarah Green and Mo Dunford that were giving us the couple of fuckle in the midst of all
Sarah
of that.
Green, yeah.
Certainly was her. And we've been speaking recently about Fusca, Arocht, Colleen Kuhn. Just great to see it. And long may it go, Marisha Joe. I'm sure Rishka may continue in this fashion. Right. Joe Chibby, the music for Black 47 is quite interesting as well. Brian Byrne, again, a man who has lots of connections and lots of association with the RTE Concert Orchestra. He composed the music here.
He did, yeah. I mean, Brian is most recently, he's one of the greatest workers I've ever met in my life, but he's recently been involved in something completely different, which is Hotel Transylvania 4 and The Croods 2, which are children's animations, which are amazing films as well, but very light writing in those films. You can hear it actually just on that clip that you played. There's a lot of sort of sampled sounds and I suppose our worldly sounds as opposed to old music. But Brian remembers, actually, I was talking to him the other day, actually about this film, and he remembers finishing the score in here in RT with the concert orchestra and being delighted with the way it went. And then when he went to the premiere of the film, it had been edited. I think Lance had just he had edited really quite heavily, and Brian's musical scores were completely something different, you know. But it is beautifully there's some beautiful piano pieces in it and orchestral score along with the more contemporary sounds of these samples, you know. So you have to be very careful when you're writing music for films. If it's very, very serious content, you can go completely the other way with sounds, and it sounds appropriate, you know. So, but it is an amazing score and a brilliant, brilliant film.
Let's finish this section of the programme then, listening to a little bit of the music from Black 47, featuring the piano, as you said, from Black 47, directed by Lance Daly and with music by Brian Byrne. The piano music there of Brian Byrne from the film Black 47. Back with more after this short break. Agus fáilte romhaibh rash ar an gláir speisialta ag ciliúrú aliena an lé aniu ag plé scéalta ón léhanta atá imithe thart. Welcome back to this special St. Patrick's Day arena where with some of our regular contributors we're discussing the wide range of ways in which Irish artists today have chosen to interpret or represent events in Irish history. Ar an gláir Lumsa Nocht, author June Caldwell, artist Amanda Coogan, film critic Paul Whittington, theatre director Conor Hanratty and Joe Chibby, the general manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra. It really, I suppose, this particular section of our programme will deal with the very difficult time, which is right where we are at the moment. I'm going to come to you on this, Conor Hanratty, in terms of commemorating the treaty debates, and then the civil war that subsequently happened. This is very much at the heart of one of the pieces you've chosen for us, Conor, The Treaty, the play by Colin Murphy. Just to explain what he was doing, what Colin was doing in that play and what he was opening up to us.
Well, it's an extraordinary piece that was performed both in the National Concert Hall, but then in the Irish Embassy in London, where the treaty would have been signed 100 years ago. And taking a huge quantity of documentary evidence, he sort of stages the tension of the Irish delegates in London arguing over what they can accept, what they can put into it, what they can tolerate being put into this signed agreement between the two nations. And what was amazing about this production was that it played very fast and loose with casting. So Camille Lucy Ross, one of our great comic actresses, played Winston Churchill, and we had the privilege of seeing Jane Brennan playing Eamon de Valera, among other very creative choices. But you could see the real struggle of these human beings who were standing up for what they believed in, while also the responsibility to the nation, to Irishness and everything. And, you know, I'm sure people have very strong opinions even now about what would have been signed. But to get that little window into the personal side of it was really extraordinary.
And it was something that was done in Ken Loach's film, Paul Whittington, the Wind That Shakes the Barley. He very much, he told the story here right from the War of Independence, but he brought us right up to the Civil War. And it concentrated on how men and women had fought together and then fought each other subsequently. It was so tragic in the way it expressed that story, told that story.
Yeah, and if you like, very much kind of an outsider's view of that period in our history. Him and Paul Laverty, though, are dedicated anti-imperialists, and that was kind of the undercurrent in the film. Came out in 2006, and it was a very powerful piece to see. Cillian Murphy played, he was Damien O'Donovan, and he wants nothing to do with politics. He wants to go to London and pursue a career in medicine. But his brother, who's played by Padraig Delaney, is leading the local flying column, and he gets captured by the Tans and tortured. One of their friends gets killed, and then Cillian Murphy's character is politicised. And then, of course, you get the friction between the brothers as well, which becomes the Civil War, and which is the recurring story throughout the Civil War, brother against brother, etc., etc. But it's a very powerful film, and it's very interesting to see. It had never been done before either. These flying columns that we all grew up, they're the stuff of legend, and to see when it work, and to see what it takes for people, ordinary people, to take up arms as they're doing in the Ukraine at the moment. It's a very powerful film.
And then the treaty versus anti-treaty debate is very much the fore, and you have two brothers speaking to each other then in this clip, as you mentioned, Teddy played by Padraig Delaney, Cillian Murphy playing the character of Damien, and Teddy is really begging his brother to, you know, look, give us what we need.
Damien, I've never begged another human being in my life, but I'm going to beg you now. Heart and soul. Just brother to brother.
What do you want, Damien?
Tell us where the arms are, Damien. Take amnesty. Go home and live the life you should be living. And we want Rory. But you talk to his boys, they listen to you.
You listen to me.
shot Chris Riley in the heart. I did that. You know why? I'm not going to sell out.
Yeah, sure brings back all of the emotion of The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Cillian Murphy as Damien there, not going to sell out, talking to his brother Teddy, played by Padraig Delaney from The Wind That Shakes the Barley. Unfortunately, subsequent to the great battle that was the War of Independence, the unfortunate reality of the Civil War, but eventually a settlement and a state founded after that, Amanda, we cannot say that women were, maybe their roles even within the War of Independence, not recognised, really weren't recognised. And so much of what the early state did to women, you would have to say, it beggars belief.
Yeah. All I can say is yes, with, you know, with the fire of anger as a woman of the Irish state. But I think this is where contemporary art can be very, very interesting in this reclamation. There is an amazing project at the moment in Rua Red, the art gallery in Tala. The great idea of Melissa Boyle to look at the figure of Mary Magdalene from the perspective of how the Christian Church and the Bible have written her in, how the Catholic Church have written her in, and of course the legacy of what we think of here in this country when we say the word Magdalene. And there's a couple of artists, unfortunately, I'm one of them, but I really, really want to describe to you.
Well, you're very Alice kind because you've chosen somebody else's piece to describe.
Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon's textile piece, which is a monumental textile piece. So hand-sewn, embroidered by these two artists over a two-year period, a great lockdown piece. But what they've done is actually they have reimagined the world. So the constellations, for example, they get rid of what we now know, and they put in imagined the little laundress. They put in these imagined constellations, and we're really talking about a map as a source of power. That mapping and cartography is a source of power.
I listen to Alice because she gives us a sense of what you're talking about, the source of power, and then you can go back and describe more of what's in it. Here she is. This is the introductory. There's a sound piece that runs with it as well. It features a text by Sinead Gleeson. So let's have a listen to the voice of Alice Marr then introducing and telling us about the ideas behind the map.
Art never really tells you the full story. It kind of opens the story door so that you, as the viewer, can walk into it and become part of it, or that you can set yourself in that story. Kind of the way maps are like a way of conceptualizing yourself within an environment. You know, where do I belong?
So that's Alice Marr there, just setting up the piece for us, Amanda, that you've chosen, the map.
And when you experience the piece, I mean, it is bigger than ourselves. It's double height size. It's absolutely monumental. And within it, they have little islands within this great map, constellations, the sky. And then they have little islands which are actually on the back of a red-haired figure's cloak or something like that. And we read the red hair figure to be Mary Magdalene because she traditionally had red hair within all of the visual art or material culture of her. And for example, one of these islands is called The System. And it so beautifully kind of tells it's a double height system. So on the top, they have drawn the map of all of the Magdalene institutions that hid away, marginalised and institutionalised anyone who didn't fit in to the great idea of this new republic. And underneath, upstairs, downstairs almost, underneath, they have the women who are cleaning, scrubbing, doing all of that manual labour that so traditionally women did and women who were incarcerated in these institutions did. But this piece of work then attempts to rehabilitate the notion of Mary Magdalene as a symbol and what she represents. I mean, it's very much coming through feminist theology. And Rua Red have had a series of lectures that reconfigure Mary Magdalene in who actually she was. She was a composite of figures. She was not a penitent sex worker.
Yeah, no, that's fine. She wasn't a penitent prostitute. No, she
wasn't.
She wasn't
a penitent prostitute. I was tripping up on my words there. So that kind of reclamation is actually a place where contemporary art can really...
And I guess June Caldwell, the section of stories that you have for us, in fact, is part of this. Certainly fits in exactly with what Amanda was talking about there. This is Lauren Foley, an upcoming collection of short stories called Polluted Sex. It is a reclaiming process, if I'm not putting words into your mouth, but certainly we could think of an example of somebody being a legacy bearer. That's really what we're dealing with in this collection of short stories.
Yeah, like we're talking about, it's very interesting to listen to Amanda there, we're talking about from the time of the Free State when there was actually state-sponsored silence. We've now moved in to a very different era. I call it the essential can't shut up, you know. And it's where we're able to tell the stories of our lives. And that includes, you know, our desires as well. And this new collection of short stories is brilliantly experimental, very risque in a number of levels. There's some fantastic ordinary stories of women getting out there and doing what they want and going after what they want. There's some really strange stories. Like there's one that's about a sexual liaison, I won't give too much away, on a beach, and it's kind of hung on the structure of a children's story, which makes it very, very uncomfortable reading. And Lauren is very, very good at doing this. You know, she takes us through these basic kind of premises that we weren't really allowed to talk about. She's going, I'm going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you what happened, but I'm also going to make you really uncomfortable while you listen to it. So it's fantastic. But that came on the back of other books such as Emer Martin's The Cruelty Men, who, you know, The Cruelty Men, I had never heard that phrase before, like brokers of human misery. And
these were men who came along basically and put children into care.
They were brokers because they were paid. Each child that they got into an institution, there was also, you know, money paid for that child. And, so therefore it was a production line. And it was a profitable production line. So we went from, you know, women who were literally incarcerated, often for their entire lives, if they had a baby out of wedlock, to a time now where we can speak and be and do what we want. Or can we? You know, that's the whole point. And so I did. Yeah, I chose Lauren's because I think Lauren's is right out the other end of this of this incredible timeline of state silence. And, you know, us as legacy bearers and fiction writers and poets, they're exactly that. We now are able to tell those stories. We're not silent. And it's our job. We're tasked with that job now of telling the stories which were not allowed to be told before.
And indeed, I believe there's a sequel to The Cruelty of Emer Martin that
on the way. I'm so excited.
You also mentioned Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These, wonderful retelling of that particular part of our history as well. But Polluted Sex is the one that you're particularly mentioning to us this evening, June.
Yeah, I'm really recommending it. That's out now next month, you know. And Emer Martin's It's Head Wreck, it's out this year with Lilliput Press as well.
Okay, back with more after this break. Fáilte Rud Arás, welcome back to our St. Patrick's Day special devoted to the ways in which Irish artists are responding to modern Ireland as we celebrate the centenary of the Irish state. Author June Caldwell, artist Amanda Coogan, film critic Paul Whittington, theatre director Conor Hanratty and Joe Chibby, general manager of the RTE Concert Orchestra, all with me on this St. Patrick's evening. I suppose we're going to look at, maybe we've been looking at the distant past and certainly 100 years back. We're coming into a kind of a section of the programme now, Amanda, where we're going to talk about things that are a little bit more recent, if you like. And the first one that you have for us here, it's talking about our perceptions of what are euphemistically called sometimes the new Irish. This is Anthony Haughey, Citizen 2013. Explain what's involved here.
Anthony Haughey has worked in Mosny, a direct provision centre, for years, a brilliant collaboration actually with people who are living there. He's taken from the most simple, he's taken their portraits to them getting involved in exhibitions, getting involved in, I suppose, and these exhibitions are almost like a protest. I mean, if we're talking about how we're dealing with history, this is history almost in the making. I would say a shameful part of our the last 20 years. And really what Anthony Haughey and his work is amazing for this, he's given a voice to people we mightn't see. because they are locked away up in County Meath or in the various other direct provision centres. So a really, really beautiful collaboration that also uncovers what is happening, the voice of people who are experiencing things in institutions, we might call them now. You know, when we're looking at the Ryan Report and institutions, we also are all thinking, oh my goodness, in a couple of years, are we going to be looking at the direct provision asylum seeker process as exactly that? So it is, Anthony Haughey has given these people a very beautiful, has brought their vision, their images, their culture is often.
And what's interesting here, too, is given that we're often talking about people who have had to cross borders to get here, we're talking about a cross-border collaboration between the Millennium Court Arts Centre in Portadown and the Highlands Gallery in Drogheda.
And Citizen 2013 is what is the piece particularly that I'm thinking of.
Yeah. I'm very excited to hear about an upcoming play from Pat McCabe. You're working on this, Conor Hanratty, down in Cork. You're in rehearsals at the moment, I believe. This is a play set in the noughties. It's called Country and Irish from Pat McCabe. And when I hear Pat McCabe and Country and Irish, I know I'm going to have a lot of fun and probably a lot of music in there as well. But what about this idea of looking back at recent history to explain to us or to help us understand where we are right now? Because you're talking about 20 years ago, the beginning of this millennium and that kind of raging Celtic Tiger stuff, are you?
Absolutely. This is a story of a man who has made a lot of money. He has a girlfriend who is one of our new community. She's from Poland, but she's living with him in County Longford. But everything seems to have gone wrong. And what Pat's genius idea is in this story, which was originally a radio play, but we're doing the premiere of it, turning it into a live performance, is to use our own brand of country and Irish music as a sort of a lens to look at the loneliness and the extremely strange relationships that we have with the land, with our mothers and with our loved ones. And so, you know, like, all of these songs that we're looking at in the play are about your mammy, they're about your land, or they're about your girlfriend. And there's also another lens of film noir, because this protagonist fancies himself a little bit like Walter Neff in the movie Double Indemnity. So the whole of the story of the play is him telling his story into a tape recorder. A little bit of an echo maybe of Crap's Last Tape as well. Yeah. Pat is a genius weaving this quilt together of all these crazy things that come into a very strange look at quite a recent moment in our history. But the, you know, the ramifications of the Celtic Tiger and the property boom and these things, they're all still buzzwords. And already we're looking back at this going, what were we doing?
Right, yeah. And Peter Cowan is in the cast there as well. And references to Samuel Beckett and Pet Teletubbies. Nobody but Pat McCabe could manage something like that.
Who possibly could?
I don't know. I don't think the next piece of new music needs an introduction, Joe Chibby. So I'm not going to give an introduction, but you can explain where it fits into our discussion after we hear a bit.
We've qualified for the World Cup. Go and compete. Best. We'll put them under pressure. The game is about being effective, being aggressive, winning the ball, getting on with the play. We'll put them under pressure.
Well, you know, I'm looking at Paul Whittingham and Amanda Coogan sitting opposite me, both of them smiling. Couldn't get them to sing along. I hope that June Caldwell, you were singing. I hope that Joe Chibby, you were singing. I hope that Conor Hanratty, you were singing. I suppose that immediately brings us back to very happy times, I suppose. Just the precursor to the Celtic Tiger in 1990, Italia 90, Joe.
Yeah. It's just, I love that piece of music.
It's impossible not to smile
You have to smile. It's the Horse Lips, one of the Horse Lips hits from the 1970s, Darragh Dunn. But it's actually Antony Drennan who I used to look up to when I was a musician around the town. And he's an incredible guitarist who... He played with the Coors, Moving Hearts, Mike and the Mechanics. So, you know, he's this great, great guitarist. But he took that guitar line on that particular recording. Yeah. And it was an amazing uplifting tune, all about Jackie's Army, and incredibly tribal as well. A lot of drumming, Davy Spillane's pipes.
Mm.
It was a brilliant time for, you know, Ireland socially and sporting, in sporting history, you know. So just the impact he had on the Irish psyche was immense.
Well, the impact he's had on all of us and getting a big smile out of us for sure is there as well. Yeah. Paul, you mentioned earlier in the programme, you talked about, we were talking about Irish language films. Yeah. On Colleen Kuhn, hugely successful, very well received.
Yeah.
And again, we're going back a little bit further to the 1980s. That's what the setting we have here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not out yet, actually, but I think it's one of the best Irish films yet made.
You've spoken to me about it. I'm dying to get my eyes on it.
Colin Braid, and it's sort of a piece of social history in the sense that you get a real clue as to what a not very nice place this was to be a child for very long periods of time. And this wonderful young actress who plays Koch, the little girl, she is sent to by her situation is rather dysfunctional, and her mother's having yet another child. Her father doesn't care and sees no reason to have any responsibility for his children, and she's sent to stay with her childless cousin, her mother's childless cousin, who's played by Carrie Crowley, and Andrew Bennett is the husband. And in this home, the little girl finds love. And but you hear these neighbours around saying, can the child be put to work, and so on and so forth. And you have this awful attitude to children, perhaps because there were so many of them.
And interestingly enough, this is an adaptation of a Clare Keegan novel, Foster. Fusca, the one we were speaking about recently, an adaptation of a Donal Ryan novel. English language novels finding their way into Irish language filmmaking.
Yeah.
I'd love to know, June Caldwell, if they could take Anna Burns' Milkman.
Oh my God, I would love film that. Of it. I'm so there for that to be made into a film. I mean, an awful lot of people found Milkman very claustrophobic, but I thought it was just an absolutely brilliant CCTV look at a society that's constantly demanding you look the other way. Do you know what I mean? Hmm. Like, that's it. That's the anomaly up there. It's like, say nothing to anyone, but the reality is everyone is bleating everything off to everyone else. And she just does this so perfectly inside the eyes of this young girl who's considered a weirdo because she's a bookie. She walks around reading books and, you know, she has an awful lot of thoughts going on in her head, and she is, you know, under the gaze, the unwanted gaze of a paramilitary milkman. So, I'd love to see that as a film. Oh, God, that would be great.
Anna Burns' Milkman. So, and again, very recent. And Northern Ireland, very much at the heart of that. Whatever you say, say nothing. And if you're doing an interview on a unionist politician, Conor Hanratty, don't say the word abomination, because there'll be an opera made about it.
Well, I mean, this piece is coming to the Abbey very soon. It's quite an extraordinary response. I presume I'm allowed to say that Iris Robinson said that word in connection to... She was being interviewed. There had been a man who was beaten up, and he was a gay man, and she decided to refer to such lifestyles that she'd see it as an abomination. And the extraordinary, extraordinary artist, Conor Mitchell, took vast quantities of transcripts of things that were said and has turned them into a DUP opera, as he's called it. And it is, every word of the piece is things that people said.
Real words spoken by real people in real Northern Ireland. And it will be Abomination, the DUP opera, will be at the Abbey Theatre, in fact, from next week, March the 24th, and it'll be there through until April the 2nd. I'll finish, Amanda, with, I suppose, one of the most dramatic moments in recent social history, the Repeal the Eighth campaign. And you've chosen the Repeal the Eighth artist banner from that campaign. Why does that retain such cultural resonance, do you think?
Well, again, it's Alice Marr and Rachel Fallon and Breida Mayock and Áine Phillips and many other artists. And it's this... a piece of embroidered fabric art. And if we think of banners, we think of Orange Marshes, as we're talking about.
Northern
Conor
Ireland.
Mitchell's brilliant Abomination. I cannot recommend
you've
it highly enough.
You've seen it in Belfast.
Up in the Lyric a couple of years ago. So they're holding these with that great moment of, you know, making history when we protested in the street for repeal, and the brilliant Cecily Brennan got together an artist for repeal. And so manifesting some kind of visual culture, material culture for that, these artists got together and embroidered these amazing banners and did a lot of performances with them. So walked through the streets of Limerick at the opening of EVA International. And really these pieces are exceptionally beautiful pieces and really celebratory. Yeah. Really celebratory of that revolutionary moment.
Yeah, well, despite the difficult topics that we've been touching on tonight, I hope that we've managed to be part of a celebratory evening. But we've only scratched the surface, really, of how artists are interpreting the modern Ireland and its history. What's clear is the wide range, the diversity of voices, the diversity of perspectives and interpretations being offered on who we are as we face into the next 100 years. Gurumilama, Egon Kuiger Usel, Avi Agom, Ermafaniel Anokta. Many thanks to my five panellists, Amanda Coogan, Joe Chibby, June Caldwell, Paul Whittington and Conor Hanratty. Thank them for their contributions, and I hope that they, and indeed all of you, our listeners, enjoy the rest of your St. Patrick's Day celebration.